"This is the word of the Lord." And when Jesus had crossed again in the boat to the other side, a great crowd gathered about him, and he was beside the sea. Then came one of the rulers of the synagogue, Jairus by name, and seeing him, Jesus, he fell at his feet and implored him earnestly, saying, "My little daughter is at the point of death. Come and lay your hands on her, so that she may be made well and live." And he went with him. And a great crowd, verse 24 now, the bulletin, and a great crowd followed him and thronged about him. And there was a woman who had had a discharge of blood for 12 years, and who had suffered much under many physicians, and had spent all that she had and was no better, but rather grew worse. She had heard the reports about Jesus and came up behind him in the crowd and touched his garment. For she said, "If I touch even his garments, I will be made well." And immediately the flow of blood dried up, and she felt in her body that she was healed of her disease. And Jesus, perceiving in himself that power had gone out from him, immediately turned about in the crowd and said, "Who touched my garments?" And his disciples said to him, "You see the crowd pressing around you, and yet you say, 'Who touched me?'" And he looked around to see who had done it. But the woman, knowing what had happened to her, came in fear and trembling and fell down before him and told him the whole truth. And he said to her, "Daughter, your faith has made you well. Go in peace and be healed of your disease." Verse 35. Actually, I'm going to read to 43. Verses 35 to 43. While he was still speaking, there came from the ruler's house some who said, "Your daughter is dead. Why trouble the teacher any further?" But overhearing what they said, Jesus said to the ruler of the synagogue, "Do not fear, only believe." And he allowed no one to follow him except Peter and James and John, the brother of James. They came to the house of the ruler of the synagogue, and Jesus saw a commotion, people weeping and wailing loudly. And when he had entered, he said to them, "Why are you making a commotion and weeping? The child is not dead, but sleeping." And they laughed at him. But he put them all outside and took the child's father and mother and those who were with him and went in where the child was. Taking her by the little hand, he said to her, "Talitha kumi," which means, "Little girl, I say to you, arise." And immediately the girl got up and began walking, for she was 12 years of age, and they were immediately overcome with amazement. And he strictly charged them that no one should know this and told them to give her something to eat. Would you bow your heads and pray with me as we ask the Holy Spirit to teach us? Our Father in heaven, we want to revere your word. And whether we're Christians who see this as breathed out from you, inspired and profitable for teaching, correction, and training in righteousness, or whether we really wonder if this book of stories is historical or relevant, we have to acknowledge that for thousands of years, millions of people, souls, have found hope and guidance in this book. And so, Lord, give us an open mind. Give us an open mind if we're not Christians or if we don't really buy all this Bible from God stuff, that we would hear the words. And if, God, you are real, challenge us to see what this means to know and follow Jesus. And if we are Christians, if we love the word, maybe we studied it even this morning in our personal quiet times. Maybe we'll take notes in it in the little journal notebook that Calvin just gave us as new members in the back. Even if we've known this passage, open our minds to see how this relates to us even this day. We pray this in Jesus' name. Amen. Well, this morning, we're going to see someone approaching Jesus for help, but not in the typical way. Last week, we saw 10 lepers say, crying out to him, "Lord Jesus, have mercy on us. Help us." And Jesus, in his mercy, healed them. All 10 were healed, but only one was saved. Now, that's such an interesting difference compared to this story. In this story, the focus of the middle passage, the stuff inside the sandwich that the gospel writer Mark gives us, is a woman who doesn't actually ask Jesus to help her. She actually has this almost superstitious belief that the clothes would actually touch. If she could just touch the edge of his garment, his outer cloak, she would be healed. And so I don't know about you, but every time I read a healing story in the Bible, these are one of the things I talk about. This person's healed. This person, God has miraculously fixed their problem. Have you ever thought this? How come that doesn't happen today? And how come it doesn't happen so easily and miraculously to me? Even to this day, around the world, in the name of Jesus, you've heard stories. Some of them are exaggerated internet myths, but some of them are genuine, with these sort of relics where people believe this icon or this piece of history, this was a wooden part of the cross, this water that's actually from the Jordan River in Israel. These physical things have powers. And it is so easy in North America and America, especially Christians, especially evangelical Christians, to go, psh, you know, like, oh, why really get baptized in the Jordan River? The water is the same everywhere. Well, I remember when I had the opportunity to visit Israel and Bethlehem, the very spot, supposedly, one of the three, that Jesus was actually laying in the manger. Like, you can see there's a star painted on the ground. We wait an hour to look through this hole in the rock at this potential crib, and they even built a crib and put it there. Or to go to the one of the two tombs vying for the claim that this is the actual tomb of Jesus. Or you can actually, you know, touch this part, piece of wood is from the real cross of Christ. And you think, man, it's kind of silly, kind of uneducated. But I submit to you that I don't think it's worth looking at that. I think people really want to know, how do I access the healing power of Jesus? How do I actually get him to help me? What do I do? I mean, I've read the passage so many times. Right now, I don't have any major debilitating disease that I'm aware of. But I know that people who are sick, you know, we just read these passages and we say things like, and Jesus healed her. And I know people are thinking, why not me? Why not today? And so this is such an interesting story of being broken and mended that there are 4 points to the sermon I'd like to share with you this morning. I know, 4. So save a little extra space in your paper if you're taking notes, just trying to follow the text. The first 3 points are similar, and the last point will kind of address it. The 4 points are this. Number one, when does Jesus mend us of our brokenness? When does he actually do that? We'll see a little bit about that. Secondly, who does Jesus actually choose to mend? Who gets the healing? Who actually gets the life all put back together nice and neat? Who gets the, you've been healed, go your way and be well? Who gets the so-called happy ending? Number 3, kind of getting along the same thing. What has to happen sometimes? What happens before Jesus chooses to mend us of our brokenness? So those first 3 kind of form a cluster. When does Jesus tend to mend us? Sometimes. Who does Jesus mend when of their brokenness? And what happens many times, not all, but many times before Jesus potentially mends us? And then fourthly and lastly, how do we actually find mendedness in Christ? How do we actually get whole in Jesus? What's the beginning starting point in that? And so we're going to take a look at this text here. Again, I wanted to give you the wider context of Jairus, because the story is Jesus has just done some pretty impressive things. He's cast out of demons. And he's come back across the water, and as he's walking here, there's a huge crowd around him. And at this point then, Jairus, a president of the local synagogue, which sounds impressive, but, you know, a village of a couple hundred, there are probably 2 or 3 male leaders, so he's one of them, comes up and falls down on the before Jesus, which is not a very dignified thing for a president of a local synagogue to do, and says, please come and heal my daughter. She is close to death. She's 12 years old. Please come and heal her. And Jesus says, lead the way. And as they're walking, this is where we get the story. And we again find the first point. When does Jesus choose to actually mend us? And we'll take a look here, beginning now in verse 24. And he went with him, and Jesus went with Jairus to her home. And a great crowd followed him and thronged about Jesus. And there was a woman who had a discharge of blood for 12 years, and who had suffered much under many physicians and had spent all that she had and was no better, but rather grew worse. She had heard reports about Jesus and came up behind him in the crowd and touched his garment. For she said, if I touch him, even his garments, I will be made well. And immediately the flow of blood dried up, and she felt in her body that she was healed of her disease. And Jesus, perceiving in himself that power had gone out from him, immediately turned about in the crowd and said, who touched my garments? And his disciples said to him, Rabbi, you see the crowd pressing in around you, and yet you say, who touched you? Have you ever been in a T-stop, in a T-station during rush hour? You've ever left one of our sporting venues, Fenway Park, or the TD Bank, whatever the current name of the place the Celtics play and the Bruins play, or some other concert, and it's densely packed. I'm told that's what Hong Kong's like. I've never seen that part of Hong Kong. But you're basically just, there's people always touching. And in the midst of this crowd, Jairus, a respected leader, he would be like the leader of the Parent-Teacher Association, the Rotary Club, the Civic Association, Chamber of Commerce. This is an upstanding guy in the community, well-respected, comes to Jesus and says, my daughter, my little girl is sick. My baby girl. And Jesus says, I'm going to go and help her. And then in the midst of this crowd, she's going, and then they're crowded, and then all of a sudden, we know the story, but this is not what anyone else heard. What the crowd heard was this. Jesus says, okay, lead the way. And they're walking, and all of a sudden, who touched me? And the disciples are just, I don't know if scratching their head was the ancient Jewish version of utter kind of confusion, but what do you mean who touched you? There's like people bumping up into you all around. We're in the T station. We just watched the famous thing where we just came out of this crowded place. We just had Easter baptism. It's like a fire hazard in here, right? There's no way we can move around. And now I want you to understand the timing here. What is Jairus thinking? He fought his way through the crowd to finally see the teacher, falls down before him, which kind of has to clear space. Please come quick, my daughter, close to death. That is why in New England, there are many hospitals with a parking spot reserved for clergy, which we don't really have in LA when I grew up there. But part of it was this, especially the Roman Catholic idea of final rites, last sacrament, get the priest, the Roman Catholic priest, to the hospital in time. So, you know, even I've been to the hospital on the North Shore. There's a hospital. There's like EMT, emergency clergy. And that's because get them there before they go to share the gospel or perform last rites in the Catholic tradition. And so this guy, he's like, what are you doing? Who touched you? And the disciples are sort of, they're sort of Jesus's like social calendar people. They're like, Jesus, you're supposed to go, synagogue, daughter dying. Everyone's bumping up against you. How can you say this? So let's be really clear. When does Jesus mend us, brothers and sisters and friends? Here's the point. Not in our timetable. Not when we think he should all the time. Not when we want it. And some of us, we know this. But I'm trying to tell you, this is here for our understanding. Not only is Jairus having to wait, but the woman had to wait for 12 years. Now, this is so fascinating because you have to understand. When did this woman's bleeding, we don't know for sure what this bleeding is. It could be maybe something in the uterine lining or something, or a hemorrhage. But most people seem to think it's some sort of menstrual related thing. So I'm not personally familiar with what that's all about. But that at best, the commentators, historians think some sort of menstrual disease where she was having, a release of blood for 12 years. So think about that. The number 12 shows up twice in this story. One, this woman's been having this bleeding issue for 12 years. When did that bleeding begin? That bleeding may have begun maybe soon or very the day of when Jairus' daughter was born. Just picture that. There's a 12-year-old girl. As long as she's been alive, this other woman has had bleeding. It's definitely not in our time. So for both, the woman waiting all these years and the girl still waiting few minutes. And by the way, listen very carefully. To the woman bleeding, 12 years is not the right time. But to the little girl in the Jairus, 12 minutes is not the right time. 12 years did not happen soon enough for this woman. But to the father losing his daughter, 12 minutes, 12 seconds is not enough time. It's not about how long the time is, folks. It's about Jesus saying, my timetable to mend is not necessarily your timetable. And I just imagine, I would be pretty upset if I'm bringing a child to the emergency room and the doctor is about to come and administer, you know, vital life-saving care. The nurses are going to come and stabilize my child. And all of a sudden they get a text message. And we're not talking another call from the hospital. I look over and they're watching a Vine video or something. I'm like, you're seriously watching a video when my son is in the emergency room? It's a good thing we're in the emergency room because you're going to need it in a few minutes. Because that's frustrating. But that is exactly what Jesus does. So much so that you know the end of the passage. At the very end of this passage, beginning in verse 35, while he was still speaking, there came from the ruler's house some who said this, your daughter is dead. Why trouble the teacher any further? Jesus, you missed the train. You missed the window. Let's just don't bother him. They're not blaming him. It's crowded. You know, someone apparently pickpocketed him or something. But here's the timing, friends. It's not always in our time. Now, there's hope, though, but again, it gets a little worse before we get the hope. If the first point is, when does Jesus mend us? The answer is, often not when we would want. Then the second thing is this. Who does Jesus mend? Again, there are two women in the story who seek the power of Jesus. Two women. 12 years old is pretty much the age of woman. Historically, at that time, she was almost at the marrying age and would have had children in another couple years. I mean, some of the teenagers, if you're 16 or 17-year-old woman here, you'd be already married in the ancient world with kids. Try that out, okay? And some of the parents are like, oh, I'd already be a grandmother, I mean. And so, yeah, she's like that. And so, but there's a status thing going on. Now, this is how frustrating to Jairus. He is the local synagogue ruler. He's the upstanding guy. And he's saying, my daughter, I mean, don't come for me. If I was sick, I might not bother you. But it's my baby girl. And who does Jesus stop for? What we see here, if you go back to the story, to the account in Mark, we see here. Verse 30, and Jesus, perceiving in himself, verse 30, that power had gone out from him, immediately turned about in the crowd and said, who touched my garments? And his disciples said to him, you see the crowd pressing around you, and yet you say, who touched me? And he looked around to see who had done it. But the woman, knowing what had happened to her, came in fear and trembling and fell down before him and told the whole truth. Now, why is she afraid? I mean, she think maybe she took some power she wasn't supposed to. That's part of it. But one of the things that probably every ancient Jew would have known and seen is if this woman had bleeding, it meant that she was ceremonially what? She was considered unclean. Because in the Old Testament laws, it states that a woman during her period is unclean or impure. Now, some people might think that's really harsh and kind of misogynist. In many ways, it basically sort of told all the men of Israel, hey, when your wife is having your period, don't try to have sex with her. Don't force it. In some ways, give her space. That's maybe the wisdom of God there telling all the husbands and to do that. And so basically, you know, in the Old Testament, when she had her period, she was supposed to be unclean. The husband was not supposed to have sexual relations with her. And then she was, after a number of days, she was able to be cleansed and go forward and continue. So in some ways, you're protecting a woman's sort of rights to kind of have a period in peace or something. And so the idea here is she's unclean. Now, being ceremonially unclean for a week is one thing. Being ceremonially ladies, I don't know if this is a stretch, but imagine a period. The longest period you've ever had. I don't know if she felt the same cramps. I don't know if she felt the same hormonal mood shifts. I don't know if she had PMS the whole time, because we don't know exactly what it is. I just want to tell you, for a 12-year period, that is not the worst part. The worst part is, while she's unclean, she's like the 10 lepers. She is socially isolated. She is spiritually separated. That's pretty rough. I mean, as a woman, you're like, dude, first of all, I have a period. I'm told it's part of the curse of humanity, so thanks a lot, right? The whole birthing thing and stuff. And then, secondly, I can't be around people. And now, this woman is unclean for 12 years. She is not supposed to touch people. She is not supposed to touch a respected rabbi. And whoever she touches is now unclean. That is why she's like, I'm really scared. I shouldn't even be here. pressing up against all these people and then touching the robe of the rabbi. But this is the hope. Who does Jesus meant? Both the high and the low. Who does Jesus minister to? Both those with great status and those without status. This woman, because of her 12 years of impurity, it's like the caste system in certain Hindu nations. There's four castes. A lot of Westerners think there's four groups of people in, say, massive countries like India. There's actually five groups of people. There's four castes official in the caste system, but there's a fifth group called the untouchables. They're not even good enough to be in the caste, C-A-S-T-E, system. This woman, socially, scholars tell us, she was statusless. She wasn't even just the lowest. She was like not existent. She probably had no husband. She probably, if she did, she hadn't been with him for 12 years. I mean, it's one thing to be 10 lepers in the leper colony that we saw last week. This woman, who knows who took care of her? Imagine how desperate she was. And by the way, when you're desperate, then you believe things like touching clothes heals you. You've ever been desperate, you'll try things. So, when does Jesus tend to mend us? Sometimes, not when we want. Who does Jesus tend to mend? Both the high status and those without any status. And if, again, the crowd might be totally frustrated with Jesus. The synagogue ruler needs your help for his little girl. And you're stopping for this. This is the woman that's been unclean for, I don't know, 5, 10, 12 years. And she's not even supposed to touch her. Oh, she touched me. She's not supposed to be here. That's when he heals, and that's who he heals. Thirdly, what often, not every time, but in my experience, and I think as we look in the passage, what often has to happen before Jesus mends us? And now we go to this really sad story. This would be on our news because this is such a sad story. Mark chapter 5, beginning now. See the story of this woman, verse 25. And there was a woman who had a discharge of blood for 12 years and who had suffered much under many physicians and had spent all that she had, and she was no better, but rather grew worse. Oh my goodness. Not only was she a woman in that culture who's economically and socially much more disadvantaged compared to any man, she, whatever assets or resources she had, she spent it seeing doctors. And it's not clear that the doctors sort of like treated her badly. The language of suffered much doesn't necessarily mean the doctors were bad doctors. It just meant that as they tried to prescribe treatments to her, the treatments just, she was suffering under difficult treatments. And in the end, she's broke and got worse. So let me tell you this, friends. Get ready to this. Because when will Jesus maybe heal or mend you? The answer is this. After you've tried to fix it and you've just made it worse. After you and I have done reasonable things, use the minds God has given us, use the resources, the gifts, the connections God has given us to do what is normal, and in the end, we have made it worse. In other cases, in other passages, there's a clear sense of idolatry when they should have sought Jesus first. This woman, Jesus does not say, go sin no more at the end. This woman, Jesus just actually heals her and she's sent away in that grace and that blessing. There's no hint that she was wrong to seek doctors. There's no hint that she was somehow being punished for her sins. She genuinely tried to help and they made it worse. I have a little minor story about this recently. In the last few years, been blessed with a couple hand-me-down phones or buying old mobile phones off, you know, internet auction sites and things like that. I'm not going to promote a brand or a website or anything. And so by God's grace, I've had fairly good experience with that. And so recently, my last phone battery was really, really weak. It's already had some issues. I believe the battery had already been replaced. So I began to look a little bit out there and think, well, don't have a lot to spend, but maybe we can get a decent deal on a used phone. So I found an incredibly good deal for a phone that I now have. And so this phone that I have was great. It was a great deal. It was hundreds of dollars below, but you know, sometimes it's too good to be true. So we went there, we tested it, we called it in. It was clean. It was serial number was good. All these things. Now, some of you already know the story. it's a common thing, but one that I had not experienced. Sometimes, after months or even a year, all of a sudden a used phone will no longer work. You call the service provider and they will say this: the serial number is blocked. And well, why is the serial number blocked? Because whoever was the original owner of the phone has stopped payment or has broken contract and has not paid up. So that means what? Your phone is blocked, not on this service provider's network only, but on all networks, because apparently at best, someone sold it and figured, I'm not going to keep paying for the phone because, you know, I don't own it anymore. Or at worst, they claimed and filed an insurance report, someone stole my phone, I'm going to get my own new phone, I got cash from this other idiot who bought my phone. And now, in the words of the tech support specialist I spoke to last week, she said, sir, you have a very expensive paperweight. And so, you know, I'm trying to save my family some money, kind of thinking, oh, this is really good. Try to do all the due diligence. And in the end, I kind of blew it. Now, while it might be hundreds of dollars, I've made much worse mistakes. And maybe you too. But can you relate to the idea? You really were trying to help, trying to save maybe some money or do the right thing. And in the end, you did make it worse. It really is your actions. You were trying to say something to help someone, encourage someone, and your words, you meant everything to be good and helpful, but your words hurt the person. Ever done that? You thought that by doing this action or helping this person, sort of surprised, maybe a little, you did some work on the project after your boss left. Maybe your spouse was trying to, you know, cook, but she had to go do something or he had to leave. And so you figured you'll finish the meal. Maybe you tried to do something well. And in the end, you actually made it worse. Am I the only one that's ever felt that way or done that? She went to doctors. First doctor didn't help. Second doctor didn't help. Who knows how many doctors she saw, but she did her best. And guess what? It's now worse. Ever been there? And that is humbling. That is breaking. That is brokenness. The brokenness is not just her physical body considered impure. I want to tell you, friend, this is the utter brokenness of the gospel. This is what makes you go to Jesus. I've done everything right, and it's still not good enough. I've done everything for the best reasons, but I still blew it. I tried to be the good spouse, be the good child, be the right brother or sister, be the good friend, be the good parent. I still blew it. I tried to be the right church member, right employee. I tried to do the right thing at work, and I just ruined it. I have made it worse, even though I was trying to do everything right. That is when we go to Jesus many times. And that is when, in his wisdom, he begins us on a journey of mending and wholeness. So how does that actually happen? Maybe Jesus hasn't healed our marriage or our lives or our own souls in the time we would like. Maybe we kind of don't think we're the person Jesus would bother with. And maybe we've tried and we've made it worse. So how, please, oh my goodness, how do we do this? And we see this now in the final words of Jesus in this passage. Take a look now, Mark chapter 5. Please direct your eyes to verse 30. And Jesus, perceiving in himself that power had gone out from him, immediately turned about in the crowd and said, who touched my garments? And his disciples said to him, you see the crowd pressing around you, and yet you say, who touched me? But he looked around to see who had done it. But the woman, knowing what had happened to her, came in fear and trembling and fell down before him and told him the whole truth. And he said to her, daughter, your faith has made you well. Go in peace and be healed of your disease. This passage ends in this one verse. And in this one verse, Jesus says four things. First of all, he calls her daughter. Now, this is actually a term of affection. This woman thought she was about to be rebuked. She accessed power she didn't have a right to. She touched a person, people's, that she was not supposed to and she believed was wrong. And he said, he stopped the ambulance on the way to the hospital, if you would, to say, who touched me? She's thinking, oh, this is so important. like, really, whose fault is it that Jairus' daughter died? Her fault. Of course, she doesn't know it yet because it hasn't happened, but she senses this. She thinks she's in big trouble, and Jesus looks when he knows he's waiting. Daughter. This is a little bit like when a parent sees a child doing something wrong, and actually it's not morally wrong as much as it's dangerous. I'll do this to my kids. They're like jumping, you know, on my roof or something, and I'll have to shout at, they're not usually on my roof without me most of the time, and I'll have to shout at them, and they're scared because the tone was urgent and loud and angry, and they think they're in trouble. But then sometimes, because it's, I'm not really mad, I'm just trying to get their attention, I will, you know, kneel down, put myself at their eye level and say, son, and begin to talk. Because I don't want them to think that I'm mad at them. This woman, Jesus, with a word calms her. Precious daughter. And then he says this, your faith has made you well. Go in peace and be healed of your disease. Your faith. And then this is getting to the heart of our fourth point. How do we begin to find the healing power of Jesus? And the answer, I'm going to have to word it very carefully. If you're going to take notes, I ask you to write the whole sentence down. The journey begins when you have faith in Jesus' authority. The healing journey begins, the brokenness begins to be mended, not just of body, but of soul, when you have faith in what? In Jesus' authority. I did not use the word power. And we're going to unpack this even more next week in our final message in this sermon series, Lord willing. Because power is not the same as authority. This is a kind of a theological thing. Hang in there with me because most people want the power of God. The 10 lepers last week, the 10 men who were diseased with their skin issue, they all wanted the power of Christ. They had faith in Jesus' power, but only one had faith in his authority. Do you want Jesus to just heal you? Or are you willing to say, Jesus, I want to be yours. So if you heal me or not, whatever you say, I will obey you. This woman had faith in his authority. Because she believed in his authority, she was able to experience more of his power. And this is very important. How did she access this power? By touching him. But listen carefully, please. Many will touch Jesus, but few will believe in him. Okay? In that crowd, I don't know how many people touched Jesus. Many will touch Jesus. Some will be healed by his power, but very few will have faith in his exousia in the Greek, in his authority, which includes his power, but also includes his ability to teach and speak with authority, which was so different for ancient rabbis in those days. In those days, ancient rabbis quoted other famous rabbis. That's where their authority was. They would quote other famous rabbis who quoted other famous rabbis who would eventually quote the, you know, the Torah, the Old Testament Bible. But throughout the New Testament, especially in the Gospels, you hear this phrase, Jesus taught as someone with authority. It doesn't mean he spoke with a deep voice. It means he did not have to appeal to any other famous rabbi. He spoke with clarity and a conviction and authority from God. That is why the demon left the demonized man in earlier chapter 5 because of Jesus' authority to say, demons, be gone. It's his authority that leads to his power. Some of us only want Jesus' power. So we might even get healing. Like last week we saw the 10 lepers, all 10 were healed. Jesus said, were not all 10 healed? Yes. Why was only one who came back? Go in peace. Your faith has made you and you alone well. Because lots of people want his power. Few will put faith in his authority. And that's the thing. Now, this is really important. Now, textually, why else is this true? Because you have to understand, Mark is not a fan of this woman's theology. And if you go to other parts of Mark and other parts of the Gospels and Acts, there's this almost superstitious, magical belief that touching the cloak of Jesus heals. In Acts and other books, there are times when they touched the cloaks of the apostles, or they said they even wanted the shadow of the apostles. If you could just kind of like dive under their shadow, you would be healed. He's not a fan of her theology based on all the things he's written and other things, but this is really important. her theology is not perfect. And again, sound doctrine is absolutely important. But when someone first comes to faith in Jesus' authority as a son of God, they don't have perfect theology. Even if you lived as a Christian reading the Bible for years, we're not going to all have perfect theology. One, there's not enough time to study it all. Number two, our sin nature probably still makes it hard to truly see the truth. And number three, there's some things that I think are hard for us to finally reconcile. They seem paradoxical to us, perhaps. But here's the key thing. The journey that some people already have is they've begun to have faith in his authority. This woman, all she knew is Jesus is the one with authority, so I will do whatever he says. And by the way, here's how you tell the difference. If you want his power and you've gotten his power, thank you very much. Good doing business with you. I'll, you know, pay my bill by praising you, going to church a little bit, and then I'll move on with my life. Because if you want his power and you got it, you're done. I wouldn't look at those people and call them lazy or selfish. I would call them other things, namely being they sought his power, not his authority. This woman had faith in his exousia, his authority as a son of God. So whether you're a Christian, it's faith not in his power, but in who he is, the living God who made you and holds you together. And if you're not a Christian, understand this. Jesus is doesn't want just you to obey him. He wants you completely and totally. And that is where obedience comes from. Because if I believe in Jesus' power, I may not choose to obey him. But if I believe in his authority that I fall down before him, then the obedience and the sound theology and doctrine will come. That is the beginning of being mended. So maybe you're someone who is waiting for someone to experience the power of Jesus to mend them, to forgive them of their sins. Friends, you may have to wait for not your timing. You may have to wait because maybe you feel like maybe there's other people Jesus is going to interact with first, or maybe you have to let them try it on their own first. Every parent, I think, has to learn this. At some point, this kid is going to have to learn it herself or himself. I think every boss and manager at some point, hopefully good ones, know at some point, I do my best. I can't force them. Every friend, every spouse hopefully endures and realizes at some point, I can't cram a belief into someone's mind as much as I might want to. Whether that's someone you're waiting for, God, heal this person, not just physically, but claim them for you. Help them to put faith in your authority. They may have to go and buy their own phone and in the end have a brick and just feel like they've made it worse before they come to Jesus and just barely touch him. The theology is kind of messed up. But if they have faith, that beginning kernel in his authority, he will work in his hearts. Because we're not going to Jesus for his power. We're going to him for his person. We're going to him for a relationship with him. And that's why that authority which helps us claim justice, the authority which sends us out to the world in missions, that authority that gives us our daily call as Christians to make disciples. Do you believe in the authority of Jesus over your life? Not just his power. Do you ask God to convict you of his authority in your life? Not just give me your power. Because maybe once you turn that corner and begin to see his authority, his command, and these are old school teachings. I mean, the command of God sounds so backwards, but it's really the path to begin to know Jesus really and experience his healing. Let's bow our heads and our hearts. Our great Father in heaven, when we look at Christ, help us to see he's never wanted to just give us his power. He's wanted to give us his person. We're not called to just experience his goodness and his blessings. We're called to completely put our faith in him as the authority of our lives. And Father, maybe in your wisdom, you actually hold back your blessing because you don't want us to make that mistake. Maybe in your kindness and wisdom, you say, I'm waiting to bless you with healing or power for the day you've tried all your things and you still made it worse. And in that day, when we turn to you, not just for your power, but because we've done everything we can and we have to fall before your authority, then Lord, would you send us away as your child to go into the world because our faith has made us well. We ask this by the strength of your son's name.